Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Israel launches new airstrikes into Beirut, and Hezbollah militants continue to fire rockets into northern Israel. We'll have the latest on the crisis in the Middle East and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's visit to that area later in the show. But first, the mounting violence in Iraq. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki today made his first visit to the White House since taking office, and President Bush promised to supply Iraq with the tools it will need to stop the violence.
Coalition Iraqi forces will secure individual neighborhoods. We'll ensure the existence of an Iraqi security presence in the neighborhoods and gradually expand the security presence as Iraqi citizens help them root out those who instigate violence.
Well, joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Richard Wolff, Newsweek's White House correspondent. Richard, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What jumps out at you as the headline from the press conference?
Well, two things. First of all, on Iraq, the commitment by the president to have more American troops there to help with this security crackdown. You know, for those of us who went with President Bush to Baghdad a few weeks ago, there was a lot of talk then that this new Maliki plan, especially in Baghdad, would establish law and order very quickly. That clearly hasn't happened, in spite of the prime minister's assertions that things were looking better. So this increased troop presence, you know, does two things. First of all, shows there are some weaknesses there and obvious weaknesses for the Maliki security plan. And secondly, dashes, I think, the political expectations back home that somehow American troops would be coming home in fairly short order. It really doesn't look like that.
Well, as you say, certainly an end to the violence in Baghdad is important to both President Bush and the Prime Minister. Do you get any sense from what you just heard that this new plan is any better than the old one? Because since the old one, we're told that the number of shootings and bombings has grown by about 40% since then.
They don't tend to give us those operational assessments other than the bland assurances that things are better than the last time, where Prime Minister Maliki did say that he thought this plan was a lot better than previous plans, but then again, it's his plan. On the other side of things, the political framework for what's going on is clearly more hopeful in the sense that this is a national unity government and there is an Iraqi constitution in place. You know, the critical questions about who's fueling this this violence and how it can be stopped, it is very difficult to assess in Washington.
And what about the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah? Did the two leaders just seem to agree to disagree on that one?
I think they disagreed about disagreeing. I mean, this was a situation where the president used that classic euphemism that they had a frank exchange. Given that Prime Minister al-Maliki also was fairly strong about this, there obviously was very little common ground here. And it's not just about the question of civilian casualties. You know, remember that one thing that has concerned governments in the region, Arab governments across the region, is the rise of Shia power that Iran and Hezbollah represents. And another piece of that rise of Shia power is the rise of the Shia in Iraq. So we're seeing all of that being played out here. It's obviously a complex situation, but it doesn't really fit into the many different pieces of Middle East policy that President Bush is trying to achieve right now.
And Richard Wolff, Newsweek White House correspondent, thanks so much for being with us.
Anytime.
And we turn now to Iraq and Borzu Deragahi, who is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, I understand that you've been listening to the press conference as well. What do you take out of this notion of, once again, the idea that more U.S. troops will be moved into Baghdad and that this time, perhaps, they'll make a difference? Do you think that that is possible this time?
Well, it's possible. In terms of whether it will make a difference, in terms of the people that I've spoken to, in terms of security experts and people who are Middle East analysts, one person noted that, well, if they're going to take the troops from somewhere else, that means that area will be less protected and more prone to fall into the kind of lawlessness that has stricken Iraq lately. This sort of unique kind of lawlessness of the open warfare and the exploitation of the security vacuum by various armed groups.
Well, and the implication clearly is that if troops can come from somewhere else in Iraq, that the somewhere else's must be getting more peaceful. But the most recent story that you filed indicated that that was not the case.
Well, I don't think that being a sense in general that those somewhere else's are getting a lot more safe. If you look at, for example, Basra and Mosul, you know, there have been periodic times when there have been improvements in security, but then they deteriorate. As a matter of fact, ironically, we were about to do a story a little while ago about, hey, look, the situation in Mosul seems to have improved a little bit, and then all of a sudden there was this huge burst in violence in Mosul. So we're not quite sure if that will work, the sort of pacifying certain areas and then moving the troops there.
And Borzu,
from somewhere else, yeah.
You also write in the L.A. Times today that U.S. troops are now stepping up the campaign against death squads that are operating in Baghdad and have launched more than a dozen raids. What else can you tell us about the death squads? Do we know who they are? Do we know how they operate?
Well, in terms of the death squads, what many people suspect and what many Iraqi officials have said is that there are groups of gunmen, possibly with ties to various Shiite political parties, and possibly also with ties or at least the acquiescence of the Ministry of Interior, who are using the security vacuum to settle certain sectarian vendettas by abducting young Sunni men and killing them. And we see the result in that in terms of a really horrible daily harvest of bodies that are dumped around Baghdad. We don't know who these death squads are that the U.S. military has been confronting because they declined to tell us exactly who they've... they just sort of basically refer to all armed groups as the same thing. And maybe from their tactical point of view, that's correct. You know, to them it makes no difference if it's a Sunni armed group or a Shiite armed group. But in terms of kind of understanding what's going on and devising policy, some people say this makes it more complicated.
And Borzu, in the minute or so we have left, how important is it to this new government that the violence seem to be going down instead of escalating?
Well, I think it's very important in terms of winning the confidence of the Iraqi people. Right now, a lot of the Iraqi people don't really have a lot of confidence in the government, don't really have a lot of confidence in the security forces. They are turned into militias and armed groups and neighborhood watch groups as the last line of defense against people they believe are out to terrorize them.
Borzu Daragahi, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Daragahi is Baghdad Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Seen from the outside, Chinese political culture can appear stagnant, a repressive communist regime trying to keep the lid on a dynamic capitalist society. But 17 years after China's brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square, theories of freedom and justice are still being discussed, albeit quietly there. And that's what our guest Daniel Bell found when he took a gamble by leaving a high-paying job in Hong Kong to teach political theory at Beijing's Tsinghua University. His new book on Asian models of a good society is called Beyond Liberal Democracy: Political Thinking for an East Asian Context. On a sometimes scratchy line from Beijing, I asked him about things that had surprised him while teaching in China.
I was a bit surprised at how people, well, at least how the media reports quite openly in a relatively factual manner on international news. I mean, the national news is still kind of propaganda, but including reports about elections in the U.S., like in the 2004 election, it was all broadcast live and without any obvious bias in China. So why does that happen? I mean, I think the government has less to fear from, so to speak, from their perspective, they have less to fear from the model of democracy. And so I guess that leads me to thinking about alternatives to both the political status quo in China, which I don't think can be long-lasting, as well as an alternatives to kind of Western-style liberal democracy. And that's where there's a lot of ferment, a lot of political thinking here along those lines, and that's what interests me, and I guess that's what I've tried to discuss in my book, too.
Do you think that China is heading towards some sort of a soft revolution?
it might not be a revolution, but there's bound to be change. I mean, everybody agrees that, you know, 20 years from now, well, or let's say, I mean, we say 50 years from now, that the political system will be dramatically different than when it is now. And the question is, what's it going to look like? So on the one hand, it's a kind of descriptive question. You want to understand what's happening, the process of political change. But on the other hand, it's also a normative question. You understand how things ought to be. And that's where I think a lot of the traditional cultural traditions, especially Confucianism, people are appealing to Confucianism to try to think about alternatives to both the status quo and to Western-style liberal democracy.
Well, sketch that out a bit for us, if you will. What might democracy Chinese-style look like? Would we recognize it in the West?
Well, I think we'd recognize it, but it's not a model that we would necessarily find acceptable for our societies. But I think we should allow for the possibility that there are different models that may be legitimate depending on the context. And so I think the Confucian tradition very much, I mean, to use a somewhat pejorative word in English, it's a kind of elitist tradition. It values rule by the most virtuous and public-spirited members of the community, and that's a kind of ideal that's been running through China, you know, for over 2,000 years. So the question is, you know, how do we institutionalize that? And that's where I think there are many interesting ideas. I mean, there's two political thinkers. There's one called Jiang Qing, and he has published a book called Political Confucianism, which was published in China. And that's more of a kind of philosophical book. But he also discusses political institutions. But that he can't publish in mainland China. It's published in Taiwan and also on the Internet. And he discusses, for example, he proposes a tricameral legislature, which has one house for popular representation, which looks kind of democratic, like what we'd be used to, I guess. But he also proposed two other houses, and one is a kind of a Confucian house, where the deputies would be chosen not by the people, but by examination, because that's the more traditional system in China, the way of choosing political officials, right? I mean, at least before 1911. And then he also proposed another house to maintain cultural continuity, because many, in other words, it would be deputies in the house, and their task would be to maintain some sort of continuity with the past. And the government is trying to kind of incorporate the Confucian discourse. You know, they have these Confucian institutes now in many countries, including the U.S., that are meant to teach the Chinese language and about Chinese culture, and actually called Confucian Institutes. But the intellectuals are thinking a bit, you know, about ideas that are substantially different from the political system as it exists now. And they're also different than Western-style liberal democracy.
We're speaking with political scientist Daniel Bell, a Westerner who teaches political theory at Beijing's Tsinghua University. Coming up, can China teach the West something about democracy? There's more coming up here and now. About political discourse in the university classrooms of China from the point of view of one Western political scientist. Daniel Bell is teaching political theory at one of the top universities in China, Tsinghua University in Beijing. He's been telling us about how democracy might look in China. Instead of a House of Representatives and a Senate, for example, China might have an elected lower house and an upper house made up of Confucian scholars who had to win their seats by scoring high on an exam. I asked him if the West had anything to learn from a Chinese version of democracy, in the same way the West has learned from Asian art.
I think there's a lot to learn. Just when we learn about, you know, we've learned, so you mentioned Asian art, right? Western art has been so enriched by its engagement with Asian art. You know, the same has happened with Western medicine, you know. So why not with Western political ideas? I mean, they at the moment, you know, there's very little engagement with, you know, Confucian and other kind of, you know, Eastern political and philosophical ideas. So, I mean, so our own theories and practice can be enriched by serious engagement with what's happening here.
Well, it's a very interesting question, isn't it? Because if a government, in fact, does value human rights, allows people to have a voice in their own futures, do we have any right to say, well, no, that's not democratic because that's not exactly the same way that we do it?
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think the minimal condition for any decent society, and I think, you know, the government recognized it here, is, you know, basic agreement on some fundamental rights, like the right not to be tortured, the right not to be enslaved, you know, the right not to be subject to genocide. I mean, at the level of public rhetoric, you know, I think, you know, everybody agrees upon those values, except maybe for kind of terrorists or whatever. But at least in China and the U.S., you know, most reasonable people agree upon the need to protect those basic rights. But then the question is, there are more contested rights, you know, and I think democracy is one of them. And I think we should allow for different models of democracy. I mean, if the government does secure basic human rights, I don't think it does at the moment, you know, then we should allow for morally legitimate differences. And I don't think we can say this is good, this is bad, until we have a good understanding of the local situation.
In the classroom, did you find that there was anything your Chinese students did not want to talk about?
You know, it's more perhaps, I mentioned one example in an article that was published in Dissent. I mean, you know, you mentioned at the start the crackdown in 17 years ago. I mean, that's still a very sensitive issue here on you know, the June 4th, you know, crackdown in and around Tiananmen Square. In the Dissent article, I mentioned the example that I was teaching about just war and then there's a student who mentioned June 4th and should the U.S. have intervened, you know, after June 4th, as a case of just war. And I could see some of the other students were uncomfortable about discussing that in an open class situation. But in a private context, you know, in my office or in a restaurant or you know, or at home, there are no boundaries, and it's a remarkably... you know, I find it's not very hard to gain the trust of the students.
They do not want to talk about Marxism, apparently, however.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Most students are bored because they're forced to study Marxism in school, and it's not an intellectually stimulating form of Marxism. But having said that, in my department, I teach in philosophy. You do have some students, like they would be in the West, interested in the academic aspects of Marx. But I think in the mainstream view, Marxism, you know, perhaps unfortunately, I think there's a lot to learn from Marx, has been kind of discredited as a kind of discourse. You know, and that's another reason, if I can go back to the beginning of the interview, you know, why so many intellectuals are interested in Confucianism, because 20 years from now they're not going to teach Marx in schools, you know, but now it's a very important part of the curriculum in schools and in universities. What's it going to be replaced with? You know, perhaps liberalism will be part of it, but there's, to my mind, you know, it's very likely that Confucianism, you know, which is the mainstream tradition here, and also which I think has a lot of desirable aspects for modern-day societies, that's going to be part of the educational curriculum, and I think that's going to replace Marxism, if I can make one prediction in a perhaps reckless manner. I think that Confucianism will replace Marxism in schools and in universities 20 years from now.
There's also a story you tell about a student who comes to your class from another university that is run by the Communist Party and who hears you giving a different kind of lecture and essentially says, well, that's not the way I heard it.
Right, yeah. So, but, you know, that student, I got to know him well later. And you know, I guess I had a kind of a slight misunderstanding that, you know, it's called the Central Communist Party School, and that it's just there to teach, you know, propaganda. But actually, it is in many ways a serious university, and many students from there go to audit classes at Tsinghua and Beijing University. They're all next to each other, and so I think ultimately that student and most of the similar students are motivated by intellectual curiosity, and that's part of what makes it a pleasure here. Is that the students really are intellectually curious, and they're really, you know, grappling, you know, they're thinking about, you know, what's going to be the future of China? Is it liberalism? Is it Marxism? Is it Confucianism? That, to me, is why it's part of why it's very exciting to be here.
So an eye-opening experience all the way around. Daniel Bell, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Bell teaches political theory at Tsinghua University in Beijing. His new book is called Beyond Liberal Democracy, Political Thinking for an East Asian Context. As always, we welcome your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman about the growing income gap in the United States. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program
is... Lisa Rice is calling for international forces to help bring an end to fighting between Israel and the militant group Hezbollah as she wraps up a visit to the Middle East today. Secretary Rice says the U.S. wants to establish a lasting peace in the region, but she is not calling for an immediate ceasefire. This comes as air raids, rocket attacks, and escalating ground fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah. Well, joining us now to talk about the secretary's visit, as well as some additional insights, is Fawaz Jurjez. He is a history professor and Middle East analyst who has just returned home from Beirut with his family. Professor Jurjez, welcome.
Thank you.
I understand you left Beirut just last night. I wonder what the mood was as you were leaving, and how did you get out?
The mood was very despondent. I think people realized that foreigners were being evacuated, and I think there was a sense of despair, a sense of panic that was really taking hold of the community. I think the evacuation of foreign nationals intensified the feelings of panic among many Lebanese because they realized they were on their own. And I think the journey itself was really hellish. It took us about 80 hours to make it from Beirut to the States.
Well, we're certainly happy you made it back safely. And, of course, as you were leaving, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was visiting there, a surprise visit to Beirut yesterday. And she says that the United States wants a, quote, urgent and enduring peace in the Middle East. She also visited Israel yesterday. And here she is before meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert.
It is time for a new Middle East. It is time to say to those who do not want a different kind of Middle East that we will prevail, they will not.
So, Professor, do you see Secretary Rice's trip helping lead toward what she's calling for a new and different Middle East?
Well, I think the administration's, the Bush administration's point of view is that the status quo is not viable, meaning Hezbollah remaining stationed in southern Lebanon on the Lebanese-Israeli border, and then the Lebanese army must be deployed and must replace Hezbollah on the Lebanese-Syrian border. The only problem with this particular perspective is that it basically asks too much of the Lebanese government and the international community, because I think what we need to understand is that Hezbollah is not just a militia. Hezbollah is not just a rotten tooth that you can pluck out. It's people. It's a social movement. It's deeply consolidated in the Lebanese political system. Hezbollah has two ministers in the Lebanese government. Hezbollah is the most powerful political player in Lebanon.
And you just published an article in the New York Daily News that said Hezbollah is not a puppet of Syria and Iran, which help finance it. Many analysts have been suggesting that. But you say that Hezbollah and its leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, have their own agenda and their own strategy. What is that?
You know, one of the major misunderstandings about Hezbollah is that Hezbollah is a stooge, and that Iran and Syria are fighting a war by proxy in Lebanon. That is, Nasrallah takes direct orders from Iran and Syria. I think this is a great simplification of a highly complex political scene. Yes, Iran and Syria do influence the conduct and behavior of Hezbollah, but Hezbollah has a domestic agenda in Lebanon. Its domestic agenda is to become the, what I call the power broker in the Lebanese political scene. And Hezbollah also has a larger, broader regional agenda. It wants to become the vanguard of armed resistance to Israel and the American agenda in the region.
And perhaps Sheikh Nasrallah wants to become the new hero of the Arab resistance?
Absolutely. In fact, Hezbollah is perceived to be the hero of Arab resistance to Israel's military might. Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, his message, his rhetoric of resistance against Israel resonates deeply among Arabs and Muslims. And truly, regardless of how you see Hezbollah and Nasrallah, I think Nasrallah has emerged as the most powerful player in Middle Eastern politics because of his resistance to Israel, because of his resistance to America, because of his defiance, which has basically played itself on the Lebanese-Israeli scene.
Well, as is often the case in these seemingly intractable conflicts, there are calls now for international troops to come in and try to stabilize the area. And, of course, the question is, from where? You know, the U.S. and NATO and some European countries already feel overextended, do not want to get involved there. Do you see a role for the U.N. here or help coming from anywhere?
Well, I think the U.N. is already in Lebanon. As you know, it has a small force, and they're talking about expanding the U.N. force and providing the U.N. force with military muscle. The only problem with this particular equation is that you're going to shift the confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel from that from to one between the U.N. or the international force against Hezbollah. It does not resolve the problem. Yes, the engagement by the international community is crucial, but I would argue the most pivotal factor in the equation is internal dialogue within Lebanon itself.
One idea that's being reported by CNN.com, quoting Lebanese sources, is that Secretary Rice would like to bring in 10,000 Turkish and Egyptian troops to patrol the area. Do you think that would work?
You cannot bring an international force and force that particular international force on Hezbollah or the Shiite population in Lebanon who support Hezbollah, because this would basically, in fact, inflame passions in the country. Remember, I mean, Hezbollah was fighting international forces in the early 1980s against the French and the Italians and the Americans. And I would argue that if an international force was to be stationed in southern Lebanon without consensus within Lebanon itself, without enabling the Lebanese government to engage Hezbollah, I think you're going to have a major military confrontation between that international force and the Shiite community led by Hezbollah, regardless whether that international force was made up of NATO troops or even Muslim or Arab forces.
Professor, I'm told that you are planning to return to Lebanon shortly after all the difficulty you had getting out. May I ask why?
Well, first of all, the reason why I had to come because I had my children with me in Beirut, and I became extremely anxious about their safety, and of course, their mother also felt very anxious about their safety and their security. I really wanted them to come home, and they are home now. Remember, I am a scholar on the Middle East, and I think, in fact, I have a sabbatical to spend 15 months in the Middle East. I returned to America now because, first of all, I want to take a break to rest a bit and bring the children home. I feel really I can be of great use of being in the region in Beirut. Really, I mean, I think if we want to understand the Middle East, you must be there to understand really the unfolding of events. And I feel that by being there, I can really understand what's happening from within as really trying to understand what's happening from without.
Well, we certainly wish you the best. And Professor Georges, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Fawez Georges is a history professor at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. Still to come, a new film looks at how evangelical Christians are spreading the gospel around the world. You're listening to Here and Now. Soaring temperatures are pushing power systems to the limit across the country. In California, triple-digit temperatures are being blamed for nearly 30 deaths, and rolling blackouts may be needed to save power. In the Midwest, thousands are still without electricity in the St. Louis area after storms there last week. And in Queens, New York, a few thousand people still do not have power more than a week after a power failure. Officials say hundreds of businesses have lost millions of dollars because they were forced to close. Jack Donovan owns Donovan's Irish Pub in Woodside, Queens, a frequent stop for New York Mets fans on their way to Shea Stadium. And Jack, I want to ask you first, where were you when the power went out last week?
Well, I was in the pub, and it happened over a two-day period. It started Monday night, and then by 10 o'clock Tuesday night, we lost everything. We just had to close down.
I was going to say, you obviously weren't able to stay open, couldn't keep the beer cold, I guess.
Well, the beer we kept cold, we kept put ice on the beer. That's an easy one. It's all the food we have. We have a large restaurant, and we lost all of that, so we lost all the food that we had, and a lot of damage was done in a very short period of time. But what was happening out on the street, the manhole covers kept blowing, and there was just fire engines running up and down the street. It was a little chaotic and pretty scary, to be honest with you. But some of the manhole covers really blew. And they had black smoke bellowing out of the manhole covers.
What about the other businesses around you? Are they opening?
Everybody closed down. Supermarket a couple blocks away said they had $100,000 worth of loss. They lost all their produce, their frozen foods, their meats. They had to hire a dumpster just to put everything in, just to get it out of the building, you know, because, of course, odor became a problem. And in the last 2 days, I put out one night 35 bags. The other night, probably the same amount of bags of all spoiled food that we had.
So nothing you can do. You just have to toss it.
Yeah, we tried to ice some things down, which is good for a day or so. But after that, you know, the ice doesn't work, and you just lose everything.
What did Con Edison say about all of this,
and
especially about why it was taking so long?
The ironic thing is Con Edison said there was 2,500 homes and businesses without electricity, and we had that right in the immediate area, and this was most of Northwest Queens, which is, if you're familiar with New York at all, it's Long Island City, Woodside, Sunnyside, Astoria. All these places were out. I mean, you're talking a couple hundred thousand homes. How could it be 2,500? And everybody was, like, looking at each other like, there's something seriously wrong here. Where did they come up with this number? And finally, on Friday, Mayor Bloomberg said there was close to 25,000. And I would say the number's probably closer to 100,000. It was as when I left the restaurant last night, there were still people on the block that didn't have electricity.
But you have it back now.
We're not full power. We have air conditioning in our bar and one of our dining rooms. We have four dining rooms, and one dining room has air conditioning, and the rest of them don't. And Con Edison came in last evening and checked all our voltage, and they said we're way down. We're very low.
Does insurance cover any of this?
To the best of my knowledge, we're not covered by any of it. Con Edison said they'll make good on $7,000 worth of perishable foods for restaurants and businesses of that type, which is a drop in a bucket considering what we all lost. And for the residential people, they said they would give them $300 reimbursement if they had receipts for their food. Which is kind of ironic, because who saves receipts from the grocery store? You know, at least as a business, we save receipts. We do a large business. We're kind of a Woodside landmark, and people come to the restaurant and the pub before they go to the Met games. We're famous for our hamburgers, and people like to come to the Met game and have a hamburger and a beer before they go to the game, and we've lost all of that.
Well, thank you, Jack.
Okay, Gail. Nice talking to you.
Jack Donovan runs Donovan's Irish Pub in Queens, New York. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
ask you a question. What is a Christian?
A Christian is a person who believes that Jesus Christ is the only Son of God. He believes that God sent Jesus into the world to die for the sins of all people.
That is a recording produced by the Global Recording Network back in the 1930s. Known as GRN, the Network of Evangelical Missionaries has recorded and distributed Bible stories in more than 5,000 indigenous languages. A new POV documentary, Tailenders, follows their mission to spread the word of Jesus Christ in every language. Adele Horn is director, writer, and producer of the film, and she joins us now. Welcome, Adele.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
The Global Recording Network started its work in 1939, and I understand that you grew up in an evangelical family. Do you remember hearing them as a child?
My first encounter with Global Recordings Network was when I was 8 years old. My family received one of these cardboard record players in the mail. And it's a flat piece of cardboard, and when you fold it up, it's folded into thirds, and you kind of make a pyramid out of it. And there's a little phonograph needle sticking out of one edge of the cardboard. And as a child of eight, I was completely impressed by this object. So I always remembered it years later because it was just this sort of miraculous object that makes sound appear with no speakers, no electricity, just simply a piece of cardboard.
And that's the first image that we see in the film. And you're right, it's such a low-tech kind of thing. And you think, how does this work?
Absolutely. And it's simply the acoustics of the shape of the cardboard. It's quite ingenious. It actually was modeled on a children's toy from Ireland, apparently. And the Organization of Missionaries found this toy and then just started kind of simplifying it and simplifying it.
Adele, the title of your film is a word that I had never heard before, Tailenders. What is that?
The Tailenders is the name that Global Recordings Network gives the people whom they're targeting. These are indigenous peoples around the world who are the last people in the world to receive a gospel message through evangelical Christians. So they call them the Tailenders, the people at the tail end of the line in terms of the missionary effort.
And one of the things that comes through very clearly in the film is the fact that the Global Recording Network is very market savvy. We have a clip of an employee talking about their strategy.
These recordings really work well in these remote groups that are not as media savvy. They don't have electricity. They've never seen a cassette player. And these cassettes are excellent. In years gone by, it would be the same with records. They'd play records over and over and over again. They would play the record till the groove was gone. But everybody had memorized the message. They could sing the songs, and they knew those messages. And it says the same message over and over and over again. And that just cements that this is truth, this is truth, this is truth.
Adele, what do you make of that? Do you think it's the content of the stories or the fascinating technology that's so interesting to these people?
Well, I think that Global Recordings Network really counts on the fact that the media itself and the technology itself they actually call it the point of the hook. So it's the thing that gets audiences interested to listen to this gospel message, which probably or perhaps they would not be interested in hearing otherwise, but the gadgetry of the device and also the use of the local indigenous language and having that in a recording is pretty spectacular. I mean, a lot of people they're targeting haven't heard recordings at all before, and certainly not a recording in their own particular indigenous language. And Global Recordings Network is very savvy, as you heard in that clip, about kind of using marketing and using sort of subconscious desires. And they use psychology quite a bit in thinking about how to push people's buttons, as they say. Part of the reason they use the heart language, or the mother tongue, as they call it, that local indigenous language, even though, you know, in some places they could use another language, let's say in Latin America, that they could make a recording in Spanish, people would understand the recording, but the missionaries choose to use a more local language because that's the language that people trust. It's the language they heard when they were nursing at their mother's breast. It's associated with comfort and confidence. And it's the language, when you hear something in that language, you believe it. So it's very much using kind of marketing principles.
And it's also very specific principles as well. We have another clip of a missionary instructor in India who is detailing exactly how to reach these potential converts.
Are they spirit worshippers? If they are, we have some messages written for spirit worshippers. Are they Muslims? We have scripts which are prepared for Muslims. Are they Hindu? Are they Buddhist? We have scripts which can address the beliefs of those people.
And so, Adele, it does raise the question, is this an attempt to understand more about the existing culture in order to, in some sense, override them?
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. In a sense, the purpose of learning about the culture is in order to change it in a very fundamental way, because missionaries, by definition, are trying to change the cosmology or belief system of a group of people.
And sometimes it causes problems for these people, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a price to be paid when someone converts to evangelicalism. In many cases, their families back home there'll be a rift with the family or with the home village or community.
And you also make it clear that, well, at least to me, it seemed as if they are not in this to make money, but they do charge for it. They're not giving these recordings away.
The Global Recordings Network thought process on that is that if you charge for something, people will value it more highly. So putting a price on something makes it more valuable.
Do you think there's anything wrong with their method?
There are many things that they do that I would not do the same way that they do. But I also felt really privileged to be invited to enter their world and understand deeply what motivates them as missionaries, because they do feel that they're saving people's eternal souls from damnation. And so within that construct, whatever you can do to accomplish that goal is valid. But I think what's difficult for me when traveling with them was that there are a lot of material needs in the places that they're visiting, and they've chosen to spread the gospel message to the exclusion of focusing on material needs, and that was difficult to reconcile for me.
Well, certainly whatever one can say about their methods, it does seem to work. People are converting.
I think that's true. I mean, part of what I wanted to also get at in the film is that there's also a complexity to that, because you know, Global Recordings Network is using quite a bit of control, quite a few of sophisticated methods of marketing. But I think the other side of the equation is that people who receive a media message, be it from a missionary group or from any group, also have a lot of power as consumers of that media or how they're going to use that in their lives. The metaphor that I got really interested in while making the film was that anytime we make a sound, when we put words into a voice and make a sound, it conforms to its environment. And so what ends up being received is actually slightly different from what is spoken, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my argument would be that as much as people are changed by a religion that they receive, they also change that religion themselves. They make it into something different, make it something their own.
Adele Horn, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Adele Horn is director, writer, and producer of Tailenders. It airs tonight on POV on local PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Gail Harris. Join us next time for the news and these stories.